May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, my name is Nisha Sannon, and along with Brendan Schiller, we represent the appellant Martin Caldwell in this matter. As Your Honors are aware, we've raised multiple issues on appeal. However, the first issue that I'd like to address before this court is the sufficiency of evidence. And even though that's a high burden for the defendant to overcome, given that this court has to take the evidence on behalf of the government, more favorable to the government, whether or not a trier of fact could rationally find that the elements of the offense have been met. It's the elements of offense, of this offense, a felon in possession of a firearm, that I want to bring to this court's attention. In this case, unlike a majority of the cases, one of the elements is the date that the constructive possession of the firearm by Martin Caldwell had to be proved. And the reason the date in this matter is so important is because of the 5-year statute of limitations. And factually, looking at why the 5-year statute of limitations applies to this case is because on September 18th, 1998, that is the date that a search of a residence on Lawler Avenue took place where weapons were found. Two guns were found inside of a Monte Carlo parked inside the garage of the Lawler residence, and one weapon was found on top of a dresser inside the Lawler residence. The indictment on this case was brought on September 17, 2003, one day before the 5-year statute of limitations would arise. And in the indictment in 2003, the government alleged that on September 18, 1998, on or about, that Martin Caldwell was a felon in possession of a firearm. At the district court level, the trial attorney at that point made no challenge to that indictment, Your Honor. As Your Honors are aware, different counsel represented Mr. Caldwell at the trial level versus myself and Mr. Schiller, who are representing him on appeal in this matter. Your Honors, one of the elements, therefore, would have to be that this offense of felon in possession, even under red-handed being caught with a gun or under the constructive theory, would be that the possession would have had to take place on September 17, 1998, or thereafter. Because if the government were to show that it took place before the 17th, there would be a violation of the statute of limitations. Judge, under the 404B analysis, it wouldn't have to be excluded unless they were showing that he possessed it in conformity with, or that because he did it then, he's doing it again. There's no disagreement that prior possession evidence couldn't come in. But the issue before this court and what the jury had to decide was whether or not on September 17th or thereafter, Mr. Caldwell was in constructive possession. I believe both sides concede that this is a constructive possession case. The government doesn't object to that in their brief, and that's the arguments that were portrayed during trial and within the appellate brief. So the issue becomes is, based on the evidence that was provided to this jury, could they have found, as a rational trier of fact, that the possession took place, the constructive possession was on the 17th or 18th? And one of the reasons that it becomes muddled as to whether or not the jury actually found constructive possession on the 17th or 18th of September in 1998 is a jury instruction that the court gave. Also not objected. However, even though not objected by the trial at the trial level by predecessor counsel, this court can review that for plain error. What happens is instead of a de novo review by this court, it would be a review for plain error because the trial counsel did not object to that instruction. However, Your Honor, the instruction was that the date could be reasonably close to the date charged, but the government is not required to prove the alleged offense happened on the exact date. Now, counsel concedes that the government doesn't have to prove the exact date in indictment, but again, this case is different. Here, the government had to prove, in order to stay within the statute of limitations, that the constructive possession took place prior to the 17th, September 1998. Now, it's our argument that that was an improper instruction, and as Your Honor pointed out, it wasn't objected to. However, we're asking this court to look at it under the plain error doctrine. Now, let's look at the facts that were presented to the jury to show that there's no sufficient evidence that Martin Caldwell constructively possessed that weapon on September 17th or thereafter. You have evidence of Mario Young, who is a confidential informant. His initial testimony is that he sees Martin Caldwell sometime in August and early September with a 9mm. We know that doesn't take us to September 17th because he specifically doesn't say on September 17th or thereafter. We have testimony of Mario, Judge, he believed, according to the testimony, at one point he says the only time, and I'm talking about Mario Young, the only time that he ever saw Martin Caldwell with a weapon was a few days before September 17th, and he refers to the day he was arrested, which is September 17th of 1998. He says a few days before then, I saw Martin Caldwell with a weapon. That would put us to September 15th, which would be a violation of the statute of limitations. Now, there's some question of the testimony that he's been led on saying, well, I think I saw him with a gun sometime after that. But that's when the government leads him through some testimony, and he, all of a sudden he has miraculous memory. Well, Judge, it's our argument that it's not, because his initial testimony is the only time that I saw him is 2 days. But, Judge, he was arrested on the 17th, so he couldn't have seen him after the 17th with the weapon, or on the 17th. He was arrested on the 17th. No, because he got arrested on the 17th, then he became a confidential informant on behalf of the government. Judge, Your Honor, the other evidence that's presented before this court is evidence about Martin Caldwell's mother being kidnapped. That also raises a separate issue of whether or not that evidence should have been put in to this case. I'm sorry? The kidnapping? Well, however, Your Honor, the government argued that that was his motive to then... No, but... No, I don't disagree with you, Judge. What I'm showing is that the government used that as motive evidence to say, well, now he needed to protect his family. Then you have Mario Young saying, well, yeah, after his mother was kidnapped, you know, that's when he told me that he was going to get a gun to protect his family. But even that evidence, the kidnapping takes place in August of 1998, is before the September 17, 1998 deadline. So even that evidence doesn't link back to the statute of limitations. The only other evidence that the government puts forth is just linking possession of the house to Martin Caldwell. Now, it's undisputed that the house was for sale. There's some dispute. I'm sorry? The house is in his name. There's testimony. It has not been sold. There's a discrepancy as to what belongs in the house, Judge, because there was testimony presented that Mr. Caldwell had moved out in August of 1998. There were some of his possessions. The car that was in the garage was not even registered to Mr. Caldwell. It was registered to somebody else. And within that car, that's where two of the weapons were found. There were certain bills that were inside the house in September, and those were the bills for the prior month. Now, testimony provided during trial indicated by three witnesses that the defense put on. One, the real estate agent, who testified that by September 18, 1998, the house was vacant, that Mr. Caldwell wasn't living there. Two other witnesses testified that they helped Martin Caldwell move out of the house before on September 18, 1998. Well, Judge, there were certain items still in there, but also the evidence... It's vacant... Vacant means... It means zero. I don't disagree with you on it. But that... Well, Judge, I believe his testimony meant that Martin Caldwell was not living at that house anymore. That's what he meant. He said the house was vacant, Judge. But it was two other, well, that it was vacant or that he wasn't living there. Well, if you count furniture living in a house, then I wouldn't. Well, Judge, you could also sell a house or rent a house with furniture in it. It wouldn't be vacant, but you'd be selling it furnished or renting it out furnished. But going back to the evidence on the sufficiency issue of whether or not there was sufficient presented to show that he had constructive possession of any firearms or was a felon in possession before the 17th, given the fact that the jury instruction says that they could reasonably, it doesn't specifically say after the 17th, but says that the government does not have to prove the alleged offense happened on the exact date, causes plain error as to whether or not this jury found that he was in constructive possession, let's say, on September 15th. let's say in August of 1998, which would be insufficient because of the statute of limitations. The evidence shows that there is no evidence. The evidence that was elicited during this trial shows both the trier of fact in this case and this court that there was nothing to show that Martin Caldwell was even constructively in possession of a firearm. The evidence shows the exact opposite. Best case scenario for the government on the evidence that's presented is that maybe on September 15th, if you believe Mario Young, he was in possession of a firearm, but that would make this indictment and this conviction defective because it violates the statute of limitations. I see I'm running out of time for rebuttal. I'm sorry? I ran out. Sorry. There's no further questions. I sit down at this point.
I please the court, counsel. Well, there's really no problem here. The government presented sufficient evidence that he constructively possessed the weapons on September 18th, 1998. There's overwhelming evidence. The guns were found inside his house on that date, and that means it was within the statute of limitations. Defense counsel's argument is simply a red herring to divert you from all the evidence that says Martin Caldwell lived at that residence September 18th, therefore constructively possessing. Yes. Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. And it's even more overwhelming evidence to contradict the fact that he wasn't living there at the time. There was testimony that there was furniture, TVs, linen, clothes, shoes. So if his next argument was about the kidnapping of his mother and whether that should have been admitted or not, there was really nothing prejudicial about admitting that testimony. It went to his motive for possessing guns. In fact, there was testimony from Mario Young that said the defendant, who had a gun in his lap that day, told Mario Young, "I have a gun because my mother was kidnapped and the quote-unquote stick-up men are still after me." Granted, that happened earlier, probably in August, but that same gun was found in his house September 18th. So the whole point of the kidnapping was not to sully up the defendant. In fact, the district court judge gave a limiting instruction stating that there's nothing wrong with paying ransom for the release of your mother, but simply to just give context to why he had a motive to possess the firearms. Well, it was directly related to his other motive, and that was to protect his large sums of money, to wit the $57,000 in cash that was found in the home and in the garage on September 18th, 1998. Again, it's relevant to show motive. It's the fact that he could raise $100,000, meaning he had a lot of money in his possession that he had to protect. Now, the fact that he used some of that money to get the release of his mother who had been kidnapped, as the district court judge said, there's nothing wrong with that. No idea. We just know that he made some phone calls to some people, and he raised that amount of money. Now, counsel has raised in his brief that, well, it's prejudicial because we don't know how much it is. But we have direct testimony from an officer that said the defendant told him he could raise $100,000. That's evidence that we have. Nobody counted it, but it's direct evidence that it was $100,000 because the defendant said he could get that much.
Abandoned is an expectation of privacy, but maybe you can
Sure, Judge. The first problem is that he didn't even assert that he was a resident. He did not even assert a legitimate expectation of privacy, as was his burden in raising a motion to suppress. So that's the first reason. But I think the magistrate judge clearly articulated that because he did put his house up for sale, he had a diminished expectation of privacy because anybody that called the realtor could enter the home without the knowledge of the defendant. He gave up some of his privacy, and based on that diminished expectation, he lacked standing under the Fourth Amendment. And I think the defendant probably clearly saw the tension between trying to say he had standing under the Fourth Amendment, but then trying to say he didn't constructively possess the weapons on September 18th. And that's probably why he didn't even assert the fact that he owned the property or that he did have standing, as was his burden, and that was the reason why his motion to suppress was denied. Notwithstanding the fact that it was a valid warrant based on probable cause, notwithstanding the fact that even if you get that far, there's a good faith exception involved that supports the magistrate's decision. Yes, it could have been drafted to say on or about September 18th. The fact that it wasn't drafted that way. And, well, yeah, on or about September 18th. Yes. Yeah, we knew the date. Yes, Judge, the indictment could have been more specific. We could have said specifically on September 18th. The fact that we didn't, and defense counsel at trial didn't object to it, I think that issue is simply waived. But even beyond that point, even with the jury instruction and the evidence presented at trial, it was sufficient to maintain a conviction. And if there are no more questions from the panel... the government asks that you affirm the conviction.
Your Honors, my name is Brent Shaw. I have a hard job. My primary purpose was going to be to talk about the sentencing issue, but I want to make four quick points. One, while there was no challenge to the indictment, the trial counsel did attempt to raise the statute of limitations issues during trial and was denied that opportunity on various cross-examination by the judge. So I don't know if it was completely waived. Two, he tried to raise specifically the time issues in the statute of limitations. He tried to ask questions on cross-examination. There was a sidebar discussion that was disallowed. It was in regards to the timeline. It's cited in the brief in terms of the transcripts. I don't have it right now, and I apologize, Your Honor. And to be honest, I want to move on to a few other quick points. I apologize, Your Honor. The $100,000 was prejudicial. It was not only prejudicial because of the fact of it was prejudicial because there was no evidence it was true. It was mentioned constantly in the opening. It was mentioned constantly in the closing. The only testimony regarding $100,000 was that when Caldwell got the call, he told the officer, they want $250,000, I might be able to raise $100,000. That's when he got the call. When the money was actually raised, all we know is that there was some cash given. There was no testimony as to the amount of cash given. Nobody counted, called in, say this is $100,000. So not only was $100,000 prejudicial in and of itself, but it was not factually based, even though it was constantly referred to by the government. And it just seems pretty disingenuous that Caldwell could not prove by a preponderance of the evidence that he had a standing in the house, but that the government could prove beyond a reasonable doubt they constructively possessed the guns on the 18th at the same time. Something there doesn't add up and is inconsistent. If Your Honor's may, I want to talk about sentencing. As you know, there's really two different issues. There's the four-point enhancement under the guidelines, and then there's Booker, and we realize that, you know, since Palladino, this court has basically created its procedure, and in some ways implicitly rejected the argument we're making, but hasn't directly rejected the argument we're making in terms of Marx and in due process that we made in the reply. And I want to make that argument again. I want to make the point that under Marx, when a constitutional decision is being applied retroactively, and it impacts what was a standing existing statute, in this case the statute was the statute that made the sentencing guidelines mandatory, you cannot apply retroactively those parts of the decision which would increase the liability, but you must apply retroactively those parts of the decision which would benefit the defendant. We know that in at least the Ninth and the Tenth Circuit, pre-Booker and pre-Blakely, Marx has been applied to sentencing issues. It's been applied when not just to the expansion of criminal conduct, despite some of the language in some of the cases in this circuit, it's been applied to when the sentencing range has changed. We know that when Martin Caldwell committed this conduct, the sentencing guidelines were mandatory. Therefore, regardless of what the mandatory maximum was for his conduct, there was an actual maximum based on what the guidelines prescribed. We know that now that under Booker, that's gone under the remedy portion, under Breyer's portion, that there would be advisory. I don't know. I started getting feedback. Say again? You don't need to revisit Palladino, I don't think. I understand the circuit, I understand the judges, the circuit went through a lot of discussion and debate, and that was the result. But my point is, this specific issue, I don't think has been directly addressed yet, and it needs to be addressed. And I don't think it's been addressed by any circuit, as far as I know. I think that in the case of Mr. Caldwell, there should be an order that it gets remanded for resentencing, similar to Palladino, it gets remanded for resentencing, but that it can only be based on the facts proven beyond a reasonable doubt at trial. Obviously, under Palladino, we have a hard road to toe here because he was sentenced to the maximum under the range. Although we do believe that there was a legal error made in terms of the enhancement, and whether I get to that or not, we're not waiving that argument. I don't know if it's necessary to revisit Palladino, but we are raising an argument here that has not been that was not addressed by Palladino directly, we think it's a legitimate argument in terms of you cannot have retroactive application that expands the liability, and it's been applied in sentencing areas. In terms of the enhancement, there was no evidence that the enhancement has to be the guns were used in connection with another felony offense. I see my time is up. The government recited cases in which guns were found with drugs in cars. In that case, it's clear that there was drugs being transported. In this case, there was guns found in a car, in a garage. There was money in a house, and there was a small amount of marijuana in the house. The guns were not found in connection with, they were not protecting any drugs, they were not protecting any money, they weren't found in connection with any type of offense. Thank you, Your Honor.